Hello, and welcome to All in a Day's Work. My guest tonight is Lenny Abrahamson, and I think it's fair to say he is the leading Irish film director of his generation. His first feature was Adam and Paul, released in 2004, followed by Garage, What Richard Did, and Frank. His most recent film is The Little Stranger, but his global breakthrough came with Room, which was nominated for 4 Oscars in 2016, with Brie Larson winning Best Actress on the night for her role as Ma. His films have received the Holy Grail of both huge critical acclaim, whilst also enjoying big international success. But behind the red carpet and glamour, someone, somewhere, in this case the director, has got the responsibility of pulling the many strands of the filmmaking process together. I'm Gary Cook, and I'm here to find out, what's all in a day's work for Lenny Abrahamson? You're very welcome, Lenny.
Thanks, Gary. Nice to be here.
Lenny, if I could start by asking you, you have made 6 feature films. So that means on 6 different occasions, you have stepped onto the set on the first day of photography. Now, in my mind's eye, I can see the makeup people, wardrobe, props people, the cinematographer, the many assistant directors and runners, not to mention the bright and glorious stars. And they all turn to you as the man in the middle, waiting for direction. Can you describe that day? What is that like?
Well, I hate the first day. I've always hated the first day. But I've at least got used to that feeling. So I no longer panic about how bad I feel on the first day. I know that that's just part of the experience. And I think the reason why it's such a stressful day, you know, and why it's usually particularly difficult, maybe illustrate something about the job. Because on that first day, it's this clash of all the ideas you've had and the kind of ideal version of the film that you've been building in your head through all the preparation and the mulling over that's gone in the months, sometimes years before. It's the clash of that with the reality of standing there with a bunch of people trying to make something, really do it. I mean, I know writers talk about people, anybody who's ever tried to write anything knows the difference between the kind of vague, comfortable feeling of having something to say versus sitting down at a laptop or a piece of blank paper and suddenly it becoming kind of lumpy and horrible and it doesn't sound like you wanted it to. And professional writers and novelists have that experience all the time. People talk about how difficult it is. But if you can imagine that same clash of the imagined and the sort of reality happening when you're surrounded by a big crew of people who are relying on you to deliver, and also actors in whose hands, who have placed in your hands their next set of reviews, and so it's like it's this kind of the glare of other people's attention as you try and do something which is essentially quite private and also very important to you. So I think the first day is tough. I mean, the good thing is that it's not the beginning of the process. I mean, you know, if you're lucky, you've had a long time to work on it in advance. So you do have all that prep to fall back on.
I mean, obviously the first day is not the first day. You've been working on a film for a long time before it actually happens. So, I mean, how does the process start?
So the idea comes from somewhere. So it's either something that you thought about yourself. In the case of the film I'm going to make next year, for example, it's a film about a boxer called Emil Griffith, who boxed in the 1960s and 70s in the States. And that story came to me because somebody saw a documentary about him. And then I read Dom McRae's fabulous book. And then I read a book by Ron Ross. And gradually this idea of making a film about his key section of his life came into focus. So then well, in this case, we optioned, myself and Ed Guiney, who I work really closely with, optioned 2 of those books. And we did that with the help of Film 4. But what happens then is that you start thinking hard about it. I'm working with a great writer called John Raymond, an American, and we met many times, we talk, we sketch out, we're writing it together, so we sketch out shapes for, you know, how much of his life are we going to focus on, you refine the idea, you try to find the heart of what it is that, in my case, made me feel compelled to tell his story, you know, and you work towards a script. And that's a long, sometimes longer, sometimes shorter, but it's a substantial process. And while that's happening, the producer, and you are talking about how you want to make it, what sort of scale it should be at, who might be the right partners, and you start that process as well, until eventually you reach a point where you start to think, okay, is this feasible? Is anybody going to give us the money. If they are, you start thinking about casting and you start building it.
So you must spend a lot of time then, you know, convincing people of stuff and pitching stuff. And
yeah.
Does that get any easier as you've had a little bit of success? Does that get easier?
It does get easier. I mean, that's the part that is most affected by success. I mean, being a film director is a bit like being a sort of a horse that people put money on in a race, you know. So if you've had a bit of success, it's like, you know, you won a couple of races as far as those people are concerned. And so, you know, they might back you again. But if it's the right person and you're not, you know, spoofing, I think there's a great art to selling without it appearing that you're doing that. I mean, so I tend to bring up the problems and the drawbacks.
Really?
Yeah, I do. And then but I'm careful that I have sort of solutions. But I think if a person that you're looking at feels that you are wrestling with the real material rather than going in there with the sole purpose of convincing them that everything is golden, they're much more likely to trust you.
Yeah, sure. Well, I'm sure obviously very, very experienced at it. Of course, you also are with your producer, Ed Guiney, a lot, who has been with you since the beginning.
Yes. The most unusual thing I think about my career, just if you compare it to other filmmakers, is just the consistency of those relationships, that, particularly with Ed, who I've known since we were about 15. Ed's path to being a film producer was much more was much straighter than mine to be a director. I farted around a lot more, and while he was doing, you know, internships and getting associate producer credits and building his own company. But all the time we were sort of really determined to work together, and he's been involved in every film that I've made. And yeah, that just that trust. And if you're an entirely independent filmmaker, in other words, that you don't have a long-standing producerial partner, there's another level of selling that you've got to do before you even get to the people with the cash. You've got to persuade a producer to take this on. At least that part is in-house, is in family.
You're safe in that knowledge.
Exactly. And also, if Ed says, you know, that's going to be difficult, I know it's true, you know, and I adjust accordingly.
Is it important for your ego that there is someone who knows you and will tell you as it is?
I mean, in the nicest possible way, yes, he does. Like all really good collaborators, I don't always even kind of notice at the time when he's like, you know, the path has turned slightly, or he's kind of shifted me off an idea that I've been hanging on to. But he does it in a really lovely way, and I don't get defensive about it. So yes, that is important. I think in the ego department, myself and Ed are very similar in that we find the whole this sort of craziness of that aspect of the industry.
Because you must meet a lot.
Oh yeah, yeah.
Because it's an industry rife with ego.
And you do need it. You do need an ego to step out and assert your ideas, and then you need to defend them sometimes. But the stuff that circles that, people's incredible, like, satisfaction with awards and devastation with criticism, I think both myself and Ed are very sort of skeptical about that. We don't go too high. We're certainly capable of going low, but we don't sort of lose the run of ourselves if things go well. And we find the kind of adulation that some people crave very unappealing, I think. I dislike those phases. I found it difficult with Room in a way.
Well, were you surprised by the success of Room?
Yes. I mean, I had a very strong feeling about what I wanted to do when I read the novel, and I was really excited by that myself. But there is such a journey from even a film being good, even a film being very good, there's still a huge number of like possible disasters, just being ignored, just being lost in the noise, anything, not finding the right distributor. So many things can happen between a good film and it getting to an audience. It felt like a miracle that it was with the right distributor, that they really got behind it at the right time, that, you know, we found Jake, all these things that could have not happened.
What was it that attracted you particularly to Room? I mean, I know you worked hard to get the gig, basically, didn't you? To Emma Donoghue?
Yeah, I'd only made Adam and Paul and Garage by the time I pitched Room, and I was working on What Richard Did. but I read this novel and it was a very, obviously it was shortlisted for the Booker and it was a very big best-selling novel. You know, it was a hard ask to go out there and sort of say, hey, please give this amazing book that everybody wants to make into a film to me, this Irish.
Could you just remind the listeners what actually happens in Room?
So, in a way, it's about a mother and a son who are being held captive by a guy who kidnapped the mother and with whom she's been forced to have a child. And she's been raising this child in what is effectively a, you know, an 11 by 11 shed for 5 years. And spoiler alert, halfway through the story, they escape. And the book and the film that we adapted from it is about how the mother tries to interpret both the world inside Room to the boy and then explain and introduce him to the world outside. And several things about that do not lend themselves to an obvious film treatment. Sure. One is just the confinement of the space.
And was that difficult? Did you find that difficult to work in that environment?
I really liked it. I think that you asked me what attracted me to it. And when I read the novel, when I realized, because it takes you a while to realize it's told from the boy's point of view, it takes you a while to realize, oh my God, this is where they are. Because to the boy, it's a kind of complete universe. She spun this fantasy to him about where they are. And he believes that this is the entire world. He doesn't think that he's being excluded from an outside world. And when I realized that the room to the boy was the whole world, I felt that the sort of exhilarating challenge of trying to create a world for the audience, in other words, see it through his eyes. How do you make a small box not feel like a prison? And when I read the novel, I felt I kind of understood how to do that. That was what exhilarated me. You know, but again, it's a difficult pitch to an audience as well to say, look, we're going to, you know, this what's happening to this woman is awful.
Sure.
And yet what we're trying to do is tell a story about childhood, about parenting, and not have it be overwhelmed by the horror of what's gone on. So, yeah, lots of ways in which the film might not have reached its audience. When it did, it was incredibly exciting, and I don't regret anything about it. But I was on the road for nearly 6 months publicizing it,
sure.
And it was one of the films in the Oscar conversation. And so I did encounter that kind of, how would you sort of like, it's a sort of industry of elevation of these of
you
people.
You hadn't met that before?
No.
You knew it existed,
yeah.
The idea of the Oscar trail and all that kind of stuff, but you hadn't actually...
No, and I'd heard people who...
Then you did.
Yeah, I'd heard people say, oh God, you know, people said to me, you know, try and remember to eat and, you know, will you be moving to LA? And I said, what are you talking about? Why would I be moving to LA? I mean, for the publicity, I thought I'll just do what I always do, which is a few junket days here and there. But it was just
more
a
different.
Yeah, it was much more than that.
And of course, you were working with Jacob Tremblay, a young boy. Was he a part of the Oscar trial? Did he have to go in any of those interviews as well?
Oh, yeah, Jake was across so much of that. I mean, I think, yeah, because there was definitely a chance that himself may get a nomination. They're very slow to nominate kids.
Jake obviously was cast as a six-year-old boy.
The character's five. I think Jake was heading towards seven. We were really lucky. We knew from working through some auditions that no five-year-old would be able to carry it.
It's obviously difficult enough working with adult actors.
Yeah.
But, I mean, working with a child actor, what was that like?
So Monica, my wife, was out. The kids moved with us. We shot in Toronto and we all moved there. And she came out, like, I think it was on day one or two, Monica came to the set, and I was doing a scene in the film where Jake has to lose his temper with his mum. And he's a brilliant kid, but this was really big pressure for him. There's a whole crew around. And I was trying to get him to where I needed him, and he was going into that thing that kids do, which is kind of avoiding and, you know, resisting. And
adults do it.
Adults do it, they sure do, yeah. They sure do. It was really, and I looked around, and after about an hour and a half, Monica was gone. And she said, when I met her that night, she said, I couldn't bear it. I couldn't bear the stress. He is a gifted natural actor, but he was still a seven-year-old boy. And trying to get those early days to work, to make him feel comfortable enough, and knowing that the whole of your production that you've been devoting yourself to for a couple of years and all these people and all this money are hanging on whether this performance feels real or not.
Sure.
You still have to, you know, you still have to be able to deal with that intense kind of pressure, but keep it light for the child and keep it positive.
That must require a huge amount of dexterous ability to actually deal with, you know, people and their problems that they may be facing.
Sure, across all cast and crew, filmmaking is an odd job because it's this funny combination between these sorts of areas of work or expertise that don't naturally overlap, you know, organizational stuff and not sort of managing groups of people and motivating them. And
you are ultimately a super manager.
You're on the floor particularly, but in terms of the whole production, artistically, in terms of the making, you're in charge. And people want you to be in charge because there's nothing worse than them trying to make something where the director doesn't know what they want.
I mean, I've heard of cases where directors lose control of a set. I mean, what does that look like? I'm not suggesting it's ever happened to you, but
thankfully
what
it
would
hasn't.
That look like?
The analogy somebody I heard make was to soccer, you know, when they talk about the manager losing the dressing room.
Sure, sure.
Because once people don't respect what you're trying to do or don't respect, don't give you the authority, because nobody ever takes, authority is something that you're given. That you claim, but people have to, unless you're some awful dictator, you have to earn it. If you lose that, your capacity to do the one thing that's required of you as the maker is gone. And that thing is that your picture is the picture that everybody is guided by. The picture that you're carrying, the vision for the thing that you're carrying, is the organizing principle of the whole thing. And if people don't want to listen, if they won't buy into that, then the whole thing becomes this kind of, it's like this mechanism which you chuck a spanner in and suddenly what was whirring smoothly just, you know, becomes a big tangle of metal.
Do you keep control? Because a lot of the people you're working with, obviously, almost all of them are big, big stars in their own right.
Yeah.
At all levels of film.
So early on, you're helped by the fact that you're all starting out. But as you go on, if you are working with people with big reputations and big careers, there are these kinds of potential flare-ups that can be very damaging. You know, if you're working with a very, you know, with a big star and you talk about what you want to do in a scene, it's happened to me where somebody said, "Really? You want to do that? Is that not?" And the actual quote was, "Is that not a bit shit?"
Okay.
In front of, you know, again, the whole team.
Sure.
And then everybody sort of sits back and thinks, wonder what he's going to say now.
Okay.
And actually it was...
How did that go?
It was fine because I really knew what it was that we were trying to do and I was able to talk. I didn't flinch, was able to say, no, this is why I want to do this. And here's how I think it'll work. And then it was absolutely fine. I think the other thing is nobody really, really wants to take responsibility. Anyway, so they sort of want you to. So if you say to them, we could try it. I don't know if it's going to work, but if you really think so, we can. And what people will say is, no, I just wanted to air the idea, because do they really want to step in and do it? Not really.
That must be an awful lot of pressure for you to be dealing with, you know, things such as that.
And which is why, you know, when you asked earlier about was I surprised by the success of Room, I'm surprised that anything even gets made sometimes, because it is just a kind of relentless onrush of imperfection and possible, you know, demands to compromise and things
How
that
do
don't
you
quite
cope
work
with that
out.
As a somebody with a vision, you're a man with a vision, and then you're also dealing with what you describe as all of this compromise.
Yeah.
I mean, you must have several facilities in your own head for being able to deal with that.
I mean, I think, again, it's the relationships you have, like with Ed and with other collaborators that I have. But also, I sort of ultimately like it. There's a combative part of me, or not, maybe not combative, but I like the challenge of, I like the sort of circusness of it. You know, like, I write, and I am now writing more. But in a way, what suits me so much about filmmaking is having to struggle to get your idea through somehow takes, you know, I don't know, somehow it occupies those aspects of me that might otherwise turn inwards and start devouring the idea itself.
Okay.
You know, I quite like, so, and it's a bit,
it's got a positive quality to it.
It does, which
is the ability to process it.
And you feel like you've come out the other side and and been through a little fire, you know. Not again, I know, you know, nobody's life's in danger, and but your whole sense of what's about, I mean, if you care amazingly, you know, deeply about something, if you're really passionate about it, if you have a picture in your head that you really want to get out there, trying to protect it becomes like it's a very visceral kind of feeling. And you try and do that without turning into a horror, you know. And I get that some people do.
Do you sometimes have to turn into that kind of character? I mean, I know you have a very strong sense of natural leadership. Do you find that that's something that if you didn't have it, that you wouldn't be able to do it as effectively?
I think people work in different ways, right? So people come over differently. I've met filmmakers who are very successful, filmmakers who are very quiet, very shy, but all of them in some way manage to occupy that role. In other words, they get people behind them, however they do it. You know, and when I was in school, when I was a small kid, I wasn't particularly athletic. I wasn't tall. I was quite sort of, and I was always socially, like I always made friends really easy, but I wasn't like one of the leaders in the class. It took me sort of a while to sort of, I don't know, somehow come into myself in that way. But the more I understand something, if I really understand something, I can't stand seeing it messed up. And I have to step in and go, look, here's what we're going to do. And if you do that, and if what you say makes sense, people gather around that idea. And they you know, and so in that sense, yeah, there is, I suppose, a sort of impulse to lead. Sometimes you do have to you absolutely have to put your foot down. You have to be prepared for people to not be happy with you if you demand something that is going to be difficult for loads of people, but you know that it's essential for the project. But what I learned early on was, if you are the person who goes, look, I finished half an hour early every day and everybody's delighted with me and I'm incredibly helpful and no, that's fine, doesn't need to be like that, we can deal with it like this, everybody might be delighted through the course of the shoot. But as soon as you put the film together and you show them, if it doesn't work, they're not going to say, yes, but he saved us a few quid. They're going to go, this is not a good film, you know.
And the director ultimately is a person who gets it.
Yeah, either way. And you get too much praise if it works, you know, because there are so many other people involved. You get too much flack if it doesn't, but that's the deal.
Do you have any regrets in any of your films so far? Is there any one of them that you look at and kind of go, I wish I'd done this, I wish I'd done that differently?
Yeah, I would say all of them, really. you know, even the one I haven't made yet, I sort of feel that way.
You know what Woody Allen says about filmmaking, that when you're writing it, you're thinking this is going to be great. Mm. And when you're shooting it, you think this is savable. And when you're editing it, you think the whole thing is a pile of rubbish.
That's it. That's pretty accurate. I've had the feeling on every project that I've made, usually about a month out from shooting, where I go, this will end my career, but I've no choice. I just have to go ahead and do it. And actually, that no choice thing is a big part of, for me, why I think directing is where I naturally sit. If you're writing, you can walk away from the desk. But if you've committed to being on set at that time for these number of weeks and everything is already being set up, I would never have the nerve to just say, you know what, I just can't do it. I just, something in me is stubborn and determined, okay, and I'll just do it and I can't get out of it.
Can I ask you this, Lenny? Going back a long time, you made an award-winning film called The Three Joes.
I did.
You did, which I was actually in.
Yes, indeed.
Unbelievably. Just after you'd completed your degree in Trinity College in philosophy. But why did it take you 13 years to make your first feature, Adam and Paul? What kept you?
Well, I've asked myself that question. Sometimes I think I have a better understanding. Sometimes I think I kind of know, and then sometimes I don't. I was racked, I think, with self-doubt. You know, I mean, there are some positive, when I say positive, I mean some substantial reasons that aren't about my own personal failings or whatever. Like, I was also really interested in like academic life. Like I did philosophy. I loved it. I went off to the States after I made Three Joes for a little while as a postgrad. So I wasn't, I was
Stanford,
sort of in
Stanford University.
Yeah, exactly.
And what was that like?
It was, well, academically it was amazing, but I wasn't happy there. I think I wasn't happy, full stop, you know? Like my early teens were really quite good in a way, a time when sometimes people are really confused. I think I'm always a bit of a late developer. I think I had my sort of adolescent crisis in my 20s. I'm having, I was about to say, no, I haven't had my midlife crisis yet. It's a bit late. I suspect it'll come along in about 60.
There's plenty of time for it, yeah.
Exactly. No. I don't want to rush it. So I think I was just going through a sort of a time of very strong, like, personal uncertainty. So I went off and I did this thing in Stanford, but I felt kind of lonely there. I liked it academically. But I think also in my sort of gut, I knew that I wanted to do something creative, you know, and
okay,
make
and then you come back around, what, 92, 93?
Yeah, probably about 92, 93. And then it took me 10 years before I made Adam and Paul. And what I did was, so for 5 years, I sat at home trying to write, holding myself to an incredibly high standard and feeling that everything I wrote was awful and binning it.
And you also lived with Stephen Rennex.
I lived with Stephen Rennex,
exactly. Your musical collaborator.
That's right. And we did all sorts of creative work together. And I think we sort of slipped into a bit of a slump where we didn't trust ourselves enough or didn't have enough confidence to really push ourselves out there. So for about 4 years or so, I sort of was flirting with different bits of creative projects, writing, but not getting... In other words, I was on that road that many people stay on, which is... You know, which leads you 30 years later to be sitting in the pub going, you know, I'm still writing my novel. I was that person. But I think, again, it's that
stubbornness. What was the hallelujah moment? What was the moment when you went from, listen, I am not going to spend my life being sort of with Neil and I?
Yes.
Because that's
where
I was.
We really were. There were definite echoes in terms of the general level of mankiness in the apartment. Everything, it was very with Neil and I. I think there was no eureka moment, but what... A few really lucky and important things happened. The thing that was at least connected to who I am was that I just at certain points said, I cannot keep doing this. If I want to make things, I have to actually make stuff, whatever that is. And I have to lose my kind of elitist idea of what makes for valuable art and shoot anything I can get my hands on. And if you start off, you know, day one and sit down and go, right, I'm going to make a great piece of work, unless you're one of the, you know, one in 10 million who does that right off the bat, it's too much pressure and you will end up doing nothing. And that's where I was. So I basically said to myself, I have to start working. I also have to make some money. I can't keep living like this. And I got involved in making TV commercials, which I was really lucky that at the time I wanted to do that, there were some openness to younger filmmakers. And I met a guy called Johnny Spears, who was very important in all of this, who believed in me, did a test commercial with me. I started to get work. And amazingly, I discovered I can really do it because I'd only made like a short and a few bits and pieces before that.
Sure.
I can work under pressure. I got that weird grow for the pressure that I was talking about earlier on. And I love that feeling of having to produce something under those conditions. I found I was really good at persuading people to sort of see things the way I wanted, to pitch. All of that I learned a lot about. And I started to be paid and I started to go, I'm actually good at this. And then through Johnny, I met Mark O'Halloran. That was the other great stroke of luck.
Who wrote Adam and Paul.
Adam Paul, Garage and Prosperity. Yeah, absolutely. And as Mark always says, we plucked each other from obscurity. You know, and I would love and hope to work with Mark again. So that led to Adam and Paul. And it was an amazing relief. I cannot tell you the relief of making that film. Because I was full of such anger at myself for not having made a film for so long. And, you know, that belief that you can and that sort of that impulse that you've got it in you starts to go sour. You know, you start to feel like maybe I'm just one of these people that, like on X Factor, who can't sing a note but goes, I'm going to be a star. I don't care what you say, you know. So to actually get up there and belt out a song and it not be a disaster, was pretty, because other people, you know, Paddy Branagh, Damien O'Donnell and Kieran Walsh and lots of people had gone and made their first or second feature by the time I even, you know, by the time I started.
Well, you describe the high standards that you have. I mean, did that come from your family having high expectations? Because I know your father was a very high achiever, a very successful construction lawyer.
Yeah, I think it did. I think it's in the whole, I mean, even, you know, the extended family, you can see that. The value in our family was kind of academic and being clever and being good at something, really good at something. And I think that was too much, because something of that probably stopped me as well for the length of time that it did, you know, that holding yourself to standards which are not attainable. But I had been good at things and I couldn't bear the idea of not being, you know, and yet I spent 10 years living in a kind of very unhappy obscurity and not doing anything, which is ultimately not healthy. But yes, it does. But I'm funny because now with my own kids, we're very careful not to build up family myths. I mean, I've had success in the last few years, but I'd rather not make that the story of the family, you know, because I don't think that's healthy for the kids. I think it builds up either a need to emulate or a desire to kick against, neither of which are about the kid, you know, it's about you.
Is that something that, in a sense, you can't really control, though?
Yes, to an extent you can't. For example, my little girl, Nell, who's 7, in senior infants, they just did a class trip to the National Gallery, and Nell came home and said, yeah, we saw your picture, Dad, because very unbelievably, I got, you know, lovely portrait by Donald Heskey in the National Gallery. And, like, Nell's brilliant. I don't think that'll have, I hope it doesn't have any effect on her, and she still sees me as kind of overweight idiot that your daughter's supposed to think of you as.
Does your daughter see you as an overweight film director type?
She's fond of me, I think, and that's the best. Both of them are, Max and Nell.
I'd like to talk a little bit about your background as well, Lenny. You are Jewish. You're non-practicing Jewish, isn't that right?
Yes, that's right.
But you have a big, big European history of immigration, and your grandparents came. Tell us a little bit about that.
So on my dad's side, they were from probably what's now Ukraine, but then would have been a Polish area, Polish-speaking area. They came at the beginning of the 1900s. My grandfather was about 6 or 7. They moved to Newry, very poor, but he was very bright. Went to the Christian Brothers in Newry. They thought, there's a bright kid, and actually had a very good experience in the Christian Brothers, and they said, you should go down and study in Trinity, which was brilliant because they wouldn't let their Catholic students go to Trinity because there was the ban.
Yeah, but till 1970.
Till 1970, but in they were saying, well, it didn't matter for this little Jewish kid, and he may as well take advantage of the education. So he came down and worked at, you know, got a scholarship and was a fluent Irish speaker and rather amazing man. Studied medicine, became a very famous doctor in Dublin. That's my dad's side. And then my mum's side, my grandfather, who I knew, was Polish, also from the Carpathian Mountains, came over in the 1930s because of unemployment and general, you know, prejudice in Europe at that time, and came over to work in the glass bottle factory in Ringsend because he'd been working in their sister company in Belgium as just on a machine. And so I knew him really well. The first thing I ever made on film, shot with film borrowed from RTE in 1989 or 1990, was a little documentary about him with Stephen Renix. So they're all immigrants from, all grandparents are Polish, yeah. And actually, then rather remarkably, I went to Poland with my first film to the Warsaw Film Festival, where I met my wife. So now with Polish-speaking children.
And have you tried to trace your roots?
Yes. I knew the name of the town that my grandfather's family, and he was it was full Fiddler on the Roof stuff. It was a shtetl. At least half, probably more, Jewish population. He was from a family of like 10 kids. And they had, their house was just off the square in Ustrzyki Dolny, which is like a lower Ustrzyki. And it's very far from anywhere in rural Poland. One time, Monica and I and the kids were in Poland, and we said, we're going to go there and I'm going to try. And I had a vague idea But we arrived in the town, and of course, nobody knew anything. There are no Jews there anymore since the Holocaust. But we went to the town hall, right, and we said, okay, we'll give it a go. We walked around, and we said, we don't even know if these buildings are original or they've been demolished, or, and it was sort of altogether quite flat. And we experienced, and we went to the town hall, and this very nice lady said, look, there are no records for Jewish people because they were all kept by the, they were burned. And the rest of the records are church records for the Christian Poles. But she said, but there's one guy who knows everything about the history of Ustrzyki and is really interested in all that stuff. I'll call him. He's quite an eccentric guy, but I'm going to call him. So she called him, and she said, there's an Irish guy here with his Polish wife. He says his grandfather came from Ustrzyki, was Jewish, gave the name of my grandfather and said, does it ring any bells? And the guy said, listen, I'm really busy. Unless it's that guy who was nominated for an Oscar, I'm not coming in. And Monica like practically leapt off the chair and said, no, tell him it is that guy. Because what had happened was I'd done an interview for a Polish magazine and I'd been asked about my Polish connection and I talked about my grandfather from Ustrzyki Dolny. And this guy had read this because he's obsessed with anything to do with that town. This guy knew absolutely everything and in fact took us to the house that my grandfather showed us newspaper pieces and death notices and took us to my grandfather's house.
Wow. By the way, if you've just tuned in, I'm Gary Cook and I'm joined by film director Lenny Abrahamson. Now,
just in relation to some of your films, there's a real darkness in your movies and they're mainly male. They're mostly male, your films. And some of the characters are really... they're pretty flawed. There's a very strong thematic link of, you know, in Adam and Paul, you've got, you know, the heroin addicts. In Garage, you've got this alienated, desperately lonely.
Yeah.
And so it goes on right the way through up to Mr. Faraday.
Yeah.
Pretty much. And I mean, what does that say about your attitude towards men, towards masculinity?
I mean, that's interesting. I think I've made some moves to address that. In Room is absolutely sort of female led, really. And there's another one in the pipeline as well. And I think I've been guilty of that same thing, which is assuming that if in the absence of a reason to the contrary, assuming that your protagonist is going to be a man. And I think that's changing. I am not naturally optimistic as a person. And I do have a pretty dark... picture of things, I think, and I question myself in ways that are not, sometimes healthy and sometimes not. I'm drawn to those characters who don't understand themselves, who are somehow at a distance from themselves or at odds with themselves. I don't know where that comes from in me. I know I'm always, even when I've tried to make something which I think is going to be, when I start thinking about an idea which I think, great, here's a delicate, light thing. You know, a few weeks later, I found some way of giving it a kind of a shadow.
Because I remember years ago when we were all much younger and all of the lads, they were really kind of obsessed with De Niro and Al Pacino. And everyone was going around talking and quoting quoting lines from these
films. It was a sort of machismo of...
There was, but I always remember that you weren't into that. It's almost as if you kind of didn't quite identify with all of that. You know, you're talking to me, and all of this stuff.
No, it's I've always... For me, uncertainty is more interesting, generally speaking. You know, what is so toxic about social media is that people are driven immediately into these, like, absolute certainties and, you know, and somehow not being sure, not knowing, not, you know, it not, that for me is more interesting. And so I always found the fetish, you know, the fetishization of like interesting hard men gets boring after a while. I mean, listen, some of those films I absolutely love. I think Raging Bull is a masterpiece. I'm going to make a boxing film, and if it's like half that, I would be very proud.
That boxing film about Emile Griffith.
Yes.
Isn't that right? The American boxer from the 1960s.
Yes.
Who himself was bisexual.
He was bisexual, and he was at a time where it was really, you know, it's a very different period of history in the States, although maybe we're on our way back. Who knows?
And didn't one of his opponents basically, he outed him.
He outed him, yeah, publicly.
And Griffith responded by killing him, quite literally in the ring.
In the ring. So, Griffith's opponent was already weakened by a bruising fight sure. a little earlier. That shouldn't he shouldn't have been allowed to fight Griffith. He may have died in his next fight, whatever happened. But actually, yeah, Griffith just unleashed this. He was a very technical boxer, but this time he just absolutely went for it. And he could never forgive himself after. I think the reason why I'm interested in Griffith, right, if I drill down, apart from the fact that it's such an extraordinary story, and it's about race and sexuality and about what it is to be true to yourself. What's interesting about Griffith is that he never really resolved his own internalized difficulties with being gay. He tried to be honest about it, but could never do it. He was damaged by the need for him to hide from himself for so long in his life. And so it's not a hero story. It's not a male hero story. Exactly. He doesn't sort of run to the top of the steps like Rocky and declare himself to be proud of who he is at the end. He sort of does. But that interests me more.
Sure. So you're kind of coming from the issue of masculinity in a kind of sideways.
In this case, right. Certainly, yeah.
And also a film that I thought you did that and brilliantly in was Garage.
I love Garage. I think of all the films in a way, it's probably the truest to the original vision of it. You know, it's very pure as a, you know, the structure of it is very simple. And
Pat Short
was amazing.
Who is fantastic in the film. I know as well that you kind of re-edited the film at the end. You had an edit and you decided to re-edit that. Was that a big call, a big decision?
It's happened a few times. Happened on Adam and Paul as well, where big decisions have been made in the edit very close to the end. I think most people don't spend long enough in an edit. And if I'm ever giving any sort of advice to people who make films or doing any teaching, I always think it's just important to give the process its due, you know, really live with something for a long time. Don't settle for it until you know it's the best version of itself. And I remember at the end of Garage taking, I think, nearly 10 minutes out, like days before we lock picture, which is, you know, normally you're just polishing.
Well, what did it do for the film other than take 10 minutes out?
It's like the best analogy for me is musical, you know. It's rhythm, and sometimes you can't say what it does in terms of like specific pieces of information that you've gained or lost, but suddenly there's tension where there wasn't tension, like the tuning of a guitar. You know, if you've got to put a new string on a guitar and you start plucking it, it just sounds like a sort of thunking piece of tin. And you keep going until tension comes, and then it's a musical note. And it's the same with, I think what happened at the end of Garage was that we followed the journey from the end of Mr. Gallagher arriving, excuse me, for those who have seen it, when Josie learns that his life in the garage is finished and that they're going to close the garage, there was a sort of sequence we sat with him. We thought, well, isn't that the most interesting thing? This is where you really want to be with him. But funnily enough, by spending too long with the character after that and bringing him to the point where he decides to take his own life, it somehow lost. It just didn't have that tension. So we made these really bold cuts where you jump, and it suddenly came alive.
I didn't actually see it coming.
Yeah, maybe that's what
there was a very visceral quality to it. I was thinking, oh, right, this is where it's gone.
Yeah, exactly.
Which is something I noticed actually as well in the film The Little Stranger. I had this horrible feeling, and it's this sense that awful things happen sort of out of your peripheral vision.
Yes.
And they're already done, and the damage is done before you even know what you're dealing with.
Well, that's life, really, isn't it? I mean, you know, the thing about that idea that if you can mirror the experience that happens in life of going, God, how did I get here? How am I? What is it in me that makes these patterns repeat in my life? That's what really The Little Stranger is about, that actually you tend to bring into a situation the very things that are the destructive.
Well, likewise in what Richard did as well, because, you know, before we know where we are, the kid is dead.
Yeah.
You know, and how quickly things can happen. You're not being given time to process this information. This stuff happens, and it's shocking.
Good screenwriting. And I love this part of the process where you're working with the script. Like, jumping forward, for example, in a simple way in a film, or having something happen quickly and without preparation, that means that the audience has to catch up. And that active moment of, hang on, where am I, what's happened, reaffirms the connection between the person and the story. like, it's really tempting to go, okay, here are the building blocks I need to explain, and then this is going to mean something. But if you have completely explained it, you've sort of built it before it's already happened in a funny way, and you don't need to see it, you know. So removing things, creating like platforms which you sort of jump off and land is more interesting to me. And actually, so much of script development, if it's not done right, pushes in completely the opposite direction and is all wrong. And it's like, why does this character act like this? We need to understand why. Well, that's nonsense. That's like a mathematical, let's solve this equation kind of approach to filmmaking or storytelling.
Because I heard Roddy Doyle actually saying that he knew a writer who basically went from the sort of A to Z of his story.
Yeah.
And then started back at Z to get back to A, except he went to M to
yeah,
S.
Yeah, right. Yeah,
to
B, yeah, yeah.
To Y.
Yeah, yeah.
And then he got back there. It's a little bit like that.
It is a little bit like that. You have to build in the experience of discovery, of uncertainty, of finding out, of having a strange suspicion. All of those things have to sort of, that's what life is like. But it's really hard because, you know, none of this exists. It's all just,
Do you work it out in your own head, though? Is it ultimately you, or are you having conversations with other people?
I'm having conversations with other people all the time. So in The Little Stranger, there's the book itself. There's a brilliant screenwriter, Lucinda Coxon, hours spent together. And then in the shoot with actors, I'm really interested in what the actors are thinking. But at the same time, it's the give and take between that and the vision you've got. If you just hand it over, you end up with a kind of porridge of everybody's ideas. But then a very key relationship I have, and it's been going now for four films, is with Nathan Nugent, the editor.
The editor, yeah.
He's very important because Nathan knows how I work and is really good at refinding what it was in what we were doing in the shoot that's most interesting. And quite often Nathan will be the one who says, and he's brilliant, he's got a great bedside manner, he'll say things like, I just thought it's probably rubbish, in fact it's
how you like to be spoken to?
Well, no, the reason the reason I'm saying that, because I'll take ideas from anybody and they could be as direct as anything. I'm talking about when he's about to suggest losing my favorite thing, for example, which happens often, where he'll go, look, it probably won't work, but I thought, you could actually just cut that whole bit. And I'm sort of thinking, you mean the bit that is that brilliant explosive scene that we all love? And he's usually right. I mean, I lost some stuff from The Little Stranger that's like stellar performance stuff. But in the context of the whole film, you've lost that efficiency of storytelling. You've overtold the story, And finding that in an edit is hard because you've lived with it for so long. It's really hard to know how it will feel if it's the first time. And that's the biggest challenge.
Can I ask you, what do you want to achieve, Lenny?
I want to do lots more. I mean, I want to make a lot of things. I want to be more experimental in some aspects, or at least in some projects. I want to feel that I have exhausted my interest to the extent that I can. Not exhausted my interest. I want to feel that I've used whatever capacities I have as a filmmaker as fully as I can by the end. And I want to make things which are better and deeper and more personal. And I want to write more.
How much does success mean to you? Or commercial
only
success?
Unfortunately, I genuinely don't take the praise seriously. I don't think that's completely true. I think if I'd had no success, I'd be a very, the absence of it would be a problem, I think, because of who I am. I think it's bad. I think that's bad because I think, and I'm glad that I'm aware of it, because there's a danger that I will resist launching myself on some of the more personal, private and difficult projects because it doesn't suit me to fail.
How do you think that your philosophy, and you got an honours degree, you got a first philosophy. How has that kind of shaped your filmmaking, do you think?
I think the same impulse that made me interested in philosophy, it makes me interested in film. And I don't think I've done anything yet in filmmaking that sort of, I feel, reaches that standard. And that's partially what keeps me going. And I think it's why I'm more maybe quite immune to the dangers of success, which is thinking you're great, because I genuinely don't. But just to go back to what you're asking, the sorts of films that I love have a kind of depth to them, and there is a way in which you see a familiar world, but you see it in a way which is kind of, which opens it up to your experience in a way which is just rich and new. And because I think habit is the enemy of all joy and new experience and insight, you know, habitual ways of thinking and seeing things. So philosophy is a sort of, if it does anything, it makes you question the conventional ways of thinking about things. And I think really good filmmaking presents life in a way that has the capacity to surprise, to deliver insights which are kind of with a deadening hand of habit can prevent.
And I read as well that you talked about in relation to philosophy, for instance, you talked about a thing in philosophy which I remember called quiddity.
Oh, yeah.
Which is about, isn't it, cutting to the core of things?
Yeah.
Is that the philosophy of your filmmaking, that it's ultimately about the story?
Yeah, no, it is. It's about the thing, you know, and that actually the guiding, the reason why something goes wrong outside of, you know, acts of God or, you know, things that you just really can't control. But the reason why things go wrong is that you don't have that tangible thing that you're trying to, you know, a vision of that tangible thing you're trying to make. If you do, you can always go back to that. Because filmmaking, being a film director, like the one thing that everybody who does it for the first time says is, I cannot believe how many questions I had to answer. You know, as soon as you walk into the production, as soon as pre-production begins, it is a relentless stream of people coming into your office to ask you things from all different aspects of the production. Could be budget, could be schedule, could be wardrobe, could be about locations. And there's constant, and that then just gets worse through the entire process. So unless you've got something that is very strong in the middle of all that, you just get swamped. Bob Hoskins directed a film he described as being pecked to death by pigeons. So that clarity of purpose is sort of your savior. If you don't have that, you are just, Why do this rather than that? Why say yes or no, rather than no? You know, that's your job, is to know what you want.
And to conclude, Lenny, can I ask, what is the best bit of advice you've ever got and indeed ever given?
Oh, that's a tough one. So the best bit of advice I ever got was not directed at me, like, personally. It was, I watched a TV program when I was about 17 about conductors. It was Masterclass, and it was Zubin Mehta, the amazing conductor, giving a masterclass to these young conductors. And I remember this one young conductor got up and did this incredible, like, I thought, wow, he's brilliant. You know, he had all the moves, the hair was floppy, the arm was moving, it was full of passion. And Zubin Mehta got up and said, you know, the problem is you're conducting the ideal orchestra in your head, and not the one in front of you. You're not listening to the people. And he conducted the same piece, and it was suddenly a completely different piece of music. So what I learned from that was, don't, I listen to actors, I listen to what's happening, I watch what's happening. I am not living in the perfect version in my head, I'm living in the thing that I'm actually trying to make and responding to that. That was a pretty, that was a really good piece of advice. The thing I think, the best advice I've ever given, I really don't know. Maybe in the context of work. Yeah, the best advice I've given to other directors is to shut up, which is not to me, but if you walk on set and you go, right, okay, here we go. Now I want you to do this, you do this, you do this. You walk in there, stop there. Then you have just shut down all of the stuff that they may have given you. So what I tend to do, and I encourage people to do, is to just be quiet for a while. Start very small, quiet bits of rehearsal, watch what's happening and respond to it.
Lenny Abrahamson, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, and I wish you continued success for 2019. You've been listening to the Irish film director Lenny Abrahamson in conversation with me, Gary Cook. Thank you for listening, and good night.